The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. This is my counsel and my guest is Casey Kemper. He has served as a senior executive at a major real estate institution, an international bank, a large real estate development company, and a well-known endowed nonprofit. In fact, the endowment that he headed was during his tenure at Collegiate Church Corporation. He transformed a legacy portfolio of undermanaged properties into an institutional-grade portfolio. In so doing, Mr. Kemper played a major role in creating substantial real estate value. The net result was a total portfolio restructuring and an increase of more than 300% in the Collegiate Church Endowment's value. He recently retired from Collegiate Church Corporation after 20 or so years there, where he pursued a mission-based investment philosophy, and he has since co-founded a new organization called K4 Real Estate Group, a faith-based organization, which provides specialized real estate consulting services to assist property owners in creating value, building wealth, managing risk. They handle asset management, portfolio strategies, dispute resolution, and mission-focused services. Casey Kemper is also a big believer in direct investing in real estate, which he did on behalf of the churches in New York City with his past organization. He joins us for this broadcast to discuss a range of topics that revolve around real estate investing, as well as some of the changes we're seeing in society regarding the number of people who actually join service organizations or fill the pews at churches. Here's my conversation with Casey Kemper. So, you know, Casey, when just going back in time to a previous discussion, when Jonathan Schein, my colleague Jonathan Schein, introduced me to you, and he told me about your longtime affiliation with the Collegiate Churches of New York. Well, actually, the first thing that came to mind when he said that was he better be performing well. I mean, he told me that you were in charge of the endowment there, and I'm thinking he better be performing very well because I know that congregations at churches across this country are seeing dwindling membership, and it's not just so there goes a collection basket. I mean, you got to figure that the collections are going down. And it's not just churches. We're talking about things such as the Rotary Club, Lions, the Elks Club, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and so on. It seems to be kind of a social theme, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is about your insights regarding that trend, what it says about our society, why it's happening. Some of the other things I want to talk about just to kind of foreshadow the entire discussion is, in addition to that, your long tenure at the Collegiate Churches of New York, and what exactly that is, mission-focused real estate investing, your belief that direct investing in real estate and ownership of that real estate is the optimal form of property investing, your decision to retire from the Collegiate Churches of New York. You gave up on God, so you got some splaining to do, maybe even say some acts of contrition if you have any Catholic blood in your veins.
I do, and, have some, yes.
Do you? Okay, well then you know what an act of contrition is.
I certainly
then
do.
Your decision to start a faith-based consultancy known as K4 Real Estate Group and what that's all about. So how does that sound? Is there anything off limits there?
No, that sounds like a good use of our time.
Well, let's start then with the membership issue at churches and service organizations and other groups. It is, as I was saying, you know, there's a dwindling number of congregants at churches. They're not filling the pews the way they used to. It's maybe going to get even more pronounced after the coronavirus crisis. Although there are, you know, I've known over the years, I've heard priests say, you know, it takes a crisis, it takes war. Why does it take war or some other crisis to get people to show up at church? But let's talk about that trend. And the reason I'm so interested in it is because it says something about our society. Investors are always thinking in terms of thematic investing. And even though you don't invest in people necessarily showing up at a service organization or church, it
you know, you can extrapolate from there and really draw some other conclusions about what's going on in our society. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have some insights for us, or maybe just some thoughts about why people seem to be less inclined to join anything these days?
Sure, Mike. Happy to answer that. Just as a way of background, so listeners know what perspective I'm bringing. For the first 20 plus years of my career, I was with for-profit organizations, major companies, an insurance company, an investment bank, and a major real estate developer. And then the last 20 plus years, I was with the Collegiate Church Corporation, as you mentioned, the business arm of the Collegiate Churches of New York City, which are four Reformed churches, mainline Protestant churches that share an endowment. In addition, I'm currently on five not-for-profit boards of various forms and natures. So that's the perspective I'm bringing to any of the answers of the conversation
Let me just ask you about collegiate churches. Why is it called collegiate churches? Collegiate says college to me.
That's right. Has nothing to do with an educational system or a college. The collegiate church dates back to the year 1628, where it was the first church in the New World known as New Amsterdam, the lower end of Manhattan. So the Dutch, you know, Henry Hudson and that crowd brought the trading settlement to New Amsterdam, and they brought their religion with them from Holland. So it started in 1628, and as it grew, there were other churches in that vicinity which shared ministers and shared resources, so they were collegial, and that's the origin of the name.
Got it.
It has a much longer name, the Reformed Dutch Church of the City of New York, but the short form is the Collegiate Church, because in those early days, and even up until today, where there are four congregations in New York City known as the Collegiate Churches of New York plus a fifth ministry, they're still sharing resources, including the endowment that I had the privilege of overseeing for 20 years.
What major developer were you with? I was going to separately do an introduction up front,
okay,
Casey,
well, please,
but as long as
okay.
We're on it, who is
right.
The developer?
The developer was Olympia New York USA, the predecessor to Brookfield Properties. So I was there at Olympia, New York during, we'll call it the interesting times, 4 years when Canary Wharf was front and center in the Olympia, New York story. And, of course, bankruptcy was major event there, although the U.S. company, the one that I served as treasurer, did not go into bankruptcy. It was able to work things out with lenders here in the U.S. and then conform itself into Brookfield Properties.
Got it. So you have an extensive background in investing in real estate, and now here you are, freshly retired and reemployed. But what about that trend we were talking about with churches, service organizations, and others?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you've certainly identified a very important trend. It's one that we experienced at the collegiate churches while I was there, although with some really fine effort, they were able to stabilize their membership. But in recent times, a number of religious organizations have seen their attendance drop. They've seen their revenues drop. And with the current crisis, that drop is dramatic. You know, after the 9/11 crisis, we did see people return to church or the synagogue, to their house of worship in a time of need, a neat time for a focus on spirituality. Well, today, outside of what's happened here in the last week or so, you haven't even been able to get back into your house of worship. So, and the collection plate was online, which many people don't use. So definitely the secular trend and the longer-term trend has been a decline in membership and decline in revenues, a challenge across the board for houses of worship, faith-based organizations to maintain their finances and also to maintain their properties. It's a little, you know, note here on real estate. A number of houses of worship are very old. There haven't been that many new ones built, and many are in need of major CapEx. You know, the roof is leaking, and sometimes it feels like the walls are literally falling in. And with declining revenues, declining reserves, there's just not money available. So that further exacerbates the problem of people giving themselves to church. Also, you see secular trends. There's now many people saying, you know, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. So that, you know, includes everything from Pilates to yoga to, reading a book on some spiritual topic. So, you know, again, I think there's a challenge for faith-based organizations to communicate their value proposition in terms of why you should show up and be a part of a religious community.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because I remember a professor at some university. I couldn't even remember the name of the professor at the university. But the point he made was, if I have a class on religion, I draw flies. If I put spirituality in the title of the course, it's sold out. It's standing room only, or, you know, it's fulfilled and people can't even get into the class. People are much more inclined. It's moving away from dogma, it seems, and more towards the metaphysical. But what about that trend, though? I mean, why are people not joining so much?
Well, I think
not
people
just,
live
not
very
just
busy.
Churches, but not, overall.
Oh, that's right. With, you know, not-for-profit memberships are also suffering. I think people are living very busy lives these days. So we see that in membership. We also see it in commitment for boards of directors. It's harder to recruit boards to not-for-profits. And, you know, to get folks to give their time and talent to committee work, which comes with leadership in not-for-profits. So, again, it's a time thing, partly, with busy lives. And then I think it's also somehow related to our emphasis today on social media and different ways of connecting, so that we certainly felt that, right, in the last 3 months, where we're all Zooming and forming new ways of communicating and new affinities. So I think it's partly a cultural thing with the way we communicate and the way we collaborate, and partly just the busyness of life.
You know, I would add to that, what occurs to me is that Pew Research Foundation and others have shown that our faith in institutions has absolutely plummeted. I mean, Congress, as an example, has an approval rate of like 9%. The Catholic Church has had this pedophilia, child molestation issue that is massive, and it hasn't been addressed to many people's satisfaction. And other organizations, college professors, being a college professor used to be the most respected profession in the United States. Nowadays, colleges are under assault for being bastions of liberalism and anti-Americanism and so on. In just your garden variety church, I hate to refer to it that way, but churches in general, I'm not sure if where they would rank. Obviously, Catholic Church took a major hit, but when it comes to other denominations or other sects, I'm not sure where they stand or whether much research has been done in that granular. What about that? Have you seen that yourself? Have you seen people losing faith in institutions of all kinds, including churches?
Well, the short answer is yes. And as a card carrying Catholic, you know, I've experienced it. So we've seen the surveys that bear out the point you're making. And I think another trend that I observe in my own congregation and others that I know of is that it's harder and harder to attract young people to church, to the synagogue. You know, my own parish is getting older and older. You can see that year to year. And it's certainly something that I know of the Catholic Church and other churches and religious organizations are dealing with. How do we interest the young, enroll the young, younger people. And that confidence factor, I think, plays very large in the challenge. You know, those of us who are a little older have seen the good and the bad, and sometimes the ugly, over a number of years. And, you know, we maybe we're more tolerant in some ways of the things that are not good. But the young people are really looking at it very with fresh eyes and saying, some of this just doesn't work for me.
You know, that's a great point, because it is a generational thing. I noticed, for instance, when I was in Portland, Oregon, I attended some Rotary meetings, and the place was full, but it was all people well along in the years, and very few young people. They were making a major effort to try to attract younger people, and I don't think they were having a whole lot of success with that. So to some degree, it's generational, but so a lot of factors there that we've already gone over, but let's get to money, the mother's milk of politics and religion. You can't really run anything these days without money. Let's talk about what your role was at the Collegiate Churches of New York. Were you in charge of the endowment in its entirety, or were you in charge of just the real estate investing portion of that?
I was the entire endowment. And when I started there some 20 years ago, it was virtually all direct real estate, and over time, we sold off a lot of that real estate, the non-strategic sorts of things, and converted that portion of the endowment to a liquid portfolio of traditional, what we call it 60-40 model, invested in stocks and bonds. So by the time I left, it was maybe 40% direct real estate and 60% liquid, still not quite where a traditional endowment typically is, but that is in perspective of the fact that Collegiate Church always was a direct real estate investor, going back to the early 18th century when an elder of the church left 4 acres of Lower Manhattan to the church. So it started as direct real estate, and when I arrived there, it was pretty much all direct real estate, which we, again, changed over a course of time.
So when you say you took the endowment 40% direct real estate and then 60% was liquid, was that liquid 60% a mixture of all kinds of different asset classes, or was it liquid?
Yes.
It was. Okay. Now you said
we had
sold
an asset manager and a portfolio allocate, investment policy statement that I think is pretty traditional with endowments, and then an asset allocation program underneath that investment policy statement.
You sold off some of your non-strategic real estate. You said that the organization owned when you had come on board. What was non-strategic about it?
Non-strategic part was that it was essentially a group of B and C properties in Lower Manhattan, small B and C properties that were undermanaged and in great need of CapEx. So, you know, the question was, do we keep this and, you know, put money in? Is that good money after bad? Or do we sell off and redirect, reinvest in other kinds of assets? So the wiser choice was to sell off things that had passed their time and were not going to get CapEx, and take the proceeds and reinvest in a more institutional quality style of real estate.
So talk
as well
about
as create the liquid portfolio. Yeah.
So talk about, you know, you're an inveterate advocate of direct investing in real estate, is my understanding, as compared to fund investing or buying publicly traded shares and REITs and so on. Obviously, you have some of that as well, and you had some of that in the endowment as well. But a lot of people don't get into direct investing in real estate. You're an advocate of it. Talk about why direct investing in real estate, you think it's important, or why it works so well for the endowment.
But it worked well for this organization because they had a history of it and understood it. You know, the board was comfortable with it. It doesn't work for everybody, okay? So I'm not saying across the board everyone should, redirect their assets into direct real estate. But for us, it worked. We had control that comes with direct investing. Ran it economically so that it was not loaded with fees that you might incur with fund investing. And it was mostly all invested in Manhattan, although we did have investments in Philadelphia and Boston as well. So a modest amount of diversification, but it was investing in our own city, our own home turf, you know, areas that we knew well. And so it worked, that worked for us.
You hired a property manager, or was it managed by, did you have a staff that was managing it?
When we began, we were, again, 20 years ago, we were all direct, internally managed. Again, the nature of the assets was hard to attract a major property manager. So, but as we moved into institutional grade real estate, sold off the Heritage portfolio, we did hire property managers in each case and had partners for joint venture development, so that, again, it became much more of institutional quality as time progressed.
So you did take on some partners. So you did have to do some partnership real estate investing. Okay.
Yes.
So talk about property types. What property types did you deal with? Did you have your favorites, or did you try to go around the horn?
We had, we'll talk about the portfolio as it evolved into the institutional quality. There were really five direct investments. One was a joint venture development site around the campus of Marble Collegiate Church. It was a site that we assembled, and it morphed several times in terms of development use. So we were going to originally we were going to develop a hotel, and it wound up now as a new office development site. It's currently under construction. So the joint venture development at 29th and 5th, we had a Upper West Side site that we put together and eventually sold to a luxury condominium developer. But we did all the pre-development work, including the zoning and landmarks approval process. We owned a partnership interest in a mixed-use development in central Philadelphia. It was done with a local developer and J.P. Morgan Real Estate Investment. We had a 90% interest in a luxury rental apartment building in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The 10% interest was the developer who we partnered with. We also owned a suburban office building, 100% suburban office building, about 495 outer ring of Boston. So it was kind of an eclectic group of office, suburban office, office development site, luxury condominium development site, mixed-use development in central Philadelphia. So it was really opportunistic. We didn't say we're going to do the office or only apartments. We really looked for good partners and good sites and good markets.
So if I was to ask you to rattle off two or three lessons you have learned in real estate investing that you would share with other would-be real estate investors or would-be real estate investors, are there some off the cuff that you would share?
Oh, absolutely. I would be happy to share with listeners here, a paper I recently wrote called Mission Focused Real Estate, General Rules for Not-for-Profits and Faith-Based Organizations. So we can talk about how people can get a hold of that. But my point in writing this 10 general rules for not-for-profits and faith-based organizations was to, you know, share my knowledge and my lessons, if you will, some of which were earned the hard way. So let me just give you a couple of quotes out of this thing that I think are worthy of sharing. One of the rules is hire the professionals. So it says in the rules, do not engage with real estate developers without a plan created with the aid of a professional team. Many organizations have engaged too early and literally paid the price. So, you know, don't get ahead of yourself. Get the professional team in place. Then start talking to the developer. Here's another one. Caution, do not launch before hiring a skilled professional team to identify, evaluate, and manage the risk set. So before you launch any real estate initiative, you really need to think about the risks inherent in that transaction or that project. So those are a couple of things. And then another I would share is caution. Many real estate opportunities and transactions have derailed due to haphazard or dysfunctional decision-making. Remember the old adage, too many cooks in the kitchen. That's something I experienced a number of times. So it's important to have your decision-making process well understood by all the team members and then stick to it.
And I'll just let our listeners know that if you would like to get your hands on that paper, I'm just going to go ahead and give out your email address, Casey, if that's okay
yes,
with you.
Please
Kemper
do.
Advisors. So Kemper Advisors is K-E-M-P-E-R, Advisors with an O on the end. So rather than E-R at the end, it's an O. So KemperAdvisors@gmail.com in case he'll send you a copy of that. And you just hit on a subject that I wanted to talk about, which is mission-focused real estate investing. Talk about that a little bit. What's the definition of mission-focused real estate investing? Because, you know, we'll talk about K4 in a little bit. And your new organization, which talks about faith-based investing. So what's mission-focused real estate investing?
Okay, so mission-focused investing is an approach to investing which always puts the mission of the organization first. Might sound like common sense, but you'd be surprised how uncommon that is sometimes.
And you're doing this for churches at the time, so that's a special consideration, I would think.
That's right. So just for example, the joint venture development I was describing that we did on 29th Street, one of the proposals that came our way was to develop a hotel which would have a big league major club associated with it. And, it was pretty enticing. The numbers looked good on paper at least. But, you know, the church decided did not want to have a club next door because, church service starts at 11 on Sunday morning and some people might be coming out of the club shortly before that. So that was, so that's an example.
Let's just stick with the wine. Stick with wine at the altar, right?
I'm not judging anyone. I'm just saying. So, another case where a not-for-profit board that I sit on, had to look squarely at its mission because it owned a not-for-profit off-Broadway theater group that owned its own theater on the west side, and it was literally falling down. And really had to focus on the fact that we were in business to promote women in the directing and playwriting and not property management. So we wound up selling the theater and creating a small reserve fund with the proceeds. So it was, again, a focus. So what is our real mission here? Is it, running a building, a theater, or with all of the headaches that go with that? Or is it, promoting our constituency in their theater career? So it's that kind of focus. And I also would like to say it's not mission versus money. I mean, that conversation came up several times while I was at Collegiate Church. It's not mission versus money. It's how the money can serve the mission. So it's mission and money working together.
Now, eventually, of course, I guess after about 20 years or more, you made the decision to retire from Collegiate Churches of New York. What prompted that decision?
Well, 20 years is quite a long time for essentially one one show, if you will. It's a long run. I decided to move really more into a semi-retirement mode, which is, I'm not even sure what that means because I've been pretty darn busy starting this new business called K4 Real Estate Group, which I partner with a gentleman named William Ken, guy I've known for 30 years and who was a consultant with me at Collegiate Church. So we decided that there was opportunity to advise faith-based organizations, not-for-profits, and family offices. That's another dimension of our business. And Bill William Tien has several clients in that arena. So we decided this was something we'd like to do together. We enjoy it. And, you know, it's something that, that we get a lot of satisfaction out of because we're helping good people do good things.
So the name of the organization is K4 Real Estate Group. K4 yeah. stands for what?
K4 stands for Kemper, K-E-M-P-E-R, and Kin, K-I-N-N. That's K2. And since we're aspirational, we just made it K4, 2 times 2.
Okay. Always good to take it to the second or fourth power there.
Right, exactly.
So who is K4 seeking to work with, and what does it promise to do for on behalf of the clients? Because you are faith-based, so are you working strictly with churches or other religious organizations, or is it broader than that?
So I would ask folks who really want to get the full story to take a look at K4RealEstateGroup.com. That's our website. But to explain, again, we have three audiences, faith-based organizations. One, that's one. Two, not-for-profits. And three, family offices. So because of my background, 20 years at Collegiate Church Corporation, I'm really leading the charge, if you will, with the faith-based organizations and have reached out to my contacts in that world and have been assisted by some very good advisors. You know, people are helping us get this business going. And so we have two church clients today, and we have several family offices. And we're looking very closely in the not-for-profit sector for opportunity there as well. I feel like I'm doing a lot of service there, and as I mentioned earlier, I'm on 5 not-for-profit boards. So that's one aspect of helping not-for-profits, but we're also looking to see where we might be able to help them with their real estate decisions.
So if you're if you have a wealthy family that looks at K4 and they see faith-based, what's the draw of the, I mean, obviously you have the expertise and all, but
right.
if a family is just not necessarily religious or whatnot, or is that the type of family would draw somebody who a family that has a religious bent, or is it just, look, we invest successfully in real estate and that's good enough for most people?
Right. With the family office business, we are agnostic. Okay. you know, I think perhaps if they look at our website and our background and see who we are, they'll understand the perspective we're bringing. And so, you know, I think that's a good thing in that, you know, we come with values, I'll say. Bill and I are both counselors of real estate, and won't go too far into that, but that's an organization that emphasizes integrity and ethics in everything that is done. So when you belong to the Council of Real Estate, an international organization, you take a pledge, you subscribe to the highest level of service, of course, but also integrity and ethics.
Interesting. Okay, so what about the real estate market today? We obviously it's under some siege right now because of the coronavirus pandemic. But what do you see today, and what's your outlook for the real estate market?
Okay, well, it's pretty foggy right now. But you asked me, so I'll just tell you what I can see through the fog. Obviously, values are taking a hit here in the short run, different asset classes. Hotels, not only values, but cash flows, of course, before we get to values, cash flows and values. But hotels particularly hit hard. The retail business was already in a decline before the pandemic, and the crisis has only accelerated problems with the retail business. Office buildings are kind of stuck there in the middle, to be determined how we use space in office buildings going forward. And industrial properties still a favorite asset class, although I read articles that say maybe they'll take a little hit in the short run, as everything will. And multifamily, pretty strong, although, you know, people are having, people, owners and asset managers are having some trouble collecting rents, but it hasn't been a major problem so far, but we'll see what happens when stimulus starts to run out and what happens with residential property. So better asset classes of multifamily and industrial, the ones that are really suffering, retail and hotels, office is kind of in the middle there. Who knows? Everybody wants to know, well, how long till we recover? Is it years, two, is it three? It really depends on the asset class and the location and the quality of the management, all of that sort of thing. And frankly, right now, where there is debt, lender relations are going to be really important going forward, whether there's forbearance, foreclosure, whatever it may be.
So just before the coronavirus struck, real estate prices in major markets like New York and Philadelphia were really pumped up. Were you spilling over into any of the secondary markets with those dollars because the assets were just too pricey for the numbers to really pencil out properly in the gateway markets?
We weren't at Collegiate Church, but we were really focused on the Boston to Washington, D.C. Geographic sector. I mean, we called it the Amtrak portfolio, but I know a number of investors have moved money to secondary markets. And if I was investing today for Collegiate Church, I would be doing the same thing.
Well, listen, Casey, I appreciate the time. Our guest for our listeners, our guest has been Casey Kemper, former head of Collegiate Churches of New York, a long background in real estate and advocate of direct investing in real estate and faith-based and mission-focused investing. Casey, good luck with the new firm to you and your partner. And again, appreciate the time and some of the insights on real estate investing.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.